Hello and welcome to This Week I Learned, your audio guide to the most surprising discoveries and fascinating studies of the week. I'm your host, Lauren Hansen. This week I learned that if you want to look younger, stop smiling. A new study out of Western University found that smiling can make us look 2 years older than if we're just playing it straight. In the study, researchers flashed images of people with smiling, neutral, and surprised expressions, and participants had to rate the perceived age of each of those. Out of all three, the surprise face was rated the fairest of them all. But what was really surprising was that after the expression test, researchers gathered the participants and asked them to think back and recall their perceptions. Which face appeared the youngest to them now? And they said the smiling faces were the youngest looking, but that was wrong. They may assume that in hindsight that was the case, but at the time they had rated the smiling faces as older. Naturally, smiling is associated with positive values and youth, so in this instance, that societal perception seeped into the way the participants considered the expressions. The reality is, though, when we're looking at a smiling face, we can't ignore the wrinkles that form around our eyes. A look of surprise, on the other hand, smooths out those pesky wrinkles. So now you know how to pose for all photos from now until eternity. This week I learned the language you speak changes your perception of time. Language is the frame on which we build meaning, and when it comes to the concept of time, that frame differs depending on your native tongue. Let's take Swedish and English speakers, for example. They tend to think of time in terms of distance, an expanse you have to traverse. Their day, for example, is long. But Spanish and Greek speakers, well, their day is full. They think of time in terms of volume, a container to be filled. And a fascinating new study published in the Journal of Experimental Psychology put that difference of language to the test to see if the way we speak influenced the way we think. Researchers exposed 40 Spanish speakers and 40 Swedish speakers to a series of tasks. In one, both groups looked at growing lines. One line grew 4 inches in 3 seconds. The other line grew 6 inches in 3 seconds. Then each group was instructed, in their respective native languages, to estimate roughly how much time it took for each of the lines to grow. This task played with the idea of time in terms of distance, and the Swedish speakers, who think of time in terms of distance, were tripped up by the growing lines. Though both lines took only 3 seconds, the Swedish speakers thought that more time had passed, whereas the Spanish speakers knew that only 3 seconds had passed regardless of the length of the line. But when the task played with the idea of time in terms of volume, it was the Spanish speakers who were tripped up. Spanish speakers tended to think that more time had passed when a container was more full, whereas Swedish speakers could accurately gauge that only 3 seconds had passed no matter how much water was in the cup. Just to confirm this theory, researchers also tested people who were bilingual in Spanish and Swedish, and the results held. When the verbal instructions were given in Spanish, the bilingual participants had no problem figuring out how much time it took the line to grow, but they did struggle with the volume task. And when the instructions were given in Swedish, well, the reverse was true. Good with volume, not so good with distance. In other words, the language the participants spoke affected how they estimated the relative passage of time. Now, what's really interesting is that when the verbal prompt was taken away, Spanish and Swedish speakers were roughly equal in both tasks, with actually both excelling at the volume task, but both struggling under the line exercise. Researchers think the same might be true across the board, that most humans would trip up over the distance test without a language prompt, because it's our own experiential bias, since we know what it's like to move across space. From our own experience, the longer the distance, the longer the time. This week I learned that women were pirates too. During the heyday of piracy in the early 18th century, it was fairly common for the marginalized and adventurous woman to dress up as a man and go to sea. Two of the most famous female pirates were Anne Bonny and Mary Read. Both Mary and Anne were born illegitimate children, and in this time period, that was a bad life to draw. Both were dressed up as boys by their family for one reason or another, and Mary used her childhood cross-dressing as an escape from poverty as a teenager. First, she became a soldier, sailing and fighting on the seas. Then, after Mary's ship was captured by pirates, she joined them. Anne, on the other hand, used her childhood cross-dressing as an escape from her father, who wanted a very particular life for Anne. As a young woman, Anne dressed in men's clothing and joined a band of pirates, which included Mary Read, in the Caribbean. Cross-dressing really was the only way women could escape their prescribed lot in life, and certainly if they wanted to hit the seas. Women were not allowed anywhere near a ship. Their presence, it was assumed, could bring mutiny and bad luck to the ship's crew, or at the very least would obstruct the male seagoing solidarity. Besides, it was assumed they couldn't possibly be capable of all the physical strength needed of maritime labor. But the fact was that in the early 18th century, women in England, Ireland, and Europe were living tough, hard-working lives. They had grit, independence, fearlessness, and the physical strength to do anything men were doing. So they turned to cross-dressing for freedom. The pirate women tended to reveal themselves eventually to the crew. They would prove themselves more than capable, earn the respect of their fellow seamen, and inevitably dress how they wanted, unless they were fighting. In fact, women had to be, and tended to be, rowdier, braver, deadlier, bawdier, and even crazier than any men on those ships. Take this story, for example, about Mary and Anne on the pirate ship they sailed. Anne and the ship's captain, Calico Jack Rackman, had a brief affair, which ended abruptly when a British vessel was sent to capture Calico Jack's ship. When it approached the vessel, all the men, including Calico Jack, scurried below deck. But it was Mary and Anne, in disguise, of course, who held the deck, fighting off the British. The ship was eventually caught, and Calico Jack and several other pirates were sent to be hanged by the waterfront as an example to other pirates. And Anne reportedly had the most cutting burn to her one-time lover. Upon hearing of his sentence, Anne said that, quote, "If he had fought like a man, he need not have been hanged like a dog." As for the fate of Mary and Anne, well, when it was discovered they were in fact women, their sentences were lessened. Mary died in prison of what was likely typhus not too long after her trial ended, and Anne was eventually reprieved and released. After that, her story fades into history, just like that of countless other female pirates who would never be discovered or simply left to sail and die on the seven seas. This week I learn why stripes mess with your brain. Have you ever been in that position? You're looking at a striped pattern or maybe Venetian blinds or even an escalator and your eyes get a little funny, maybe you get a headache? That's because your brain doesn't know what to do with such a perfectly aligned pattern. You see, we humans have what The Guardian cleverly calls a zebra comfort zone. The stripes found on zebras, made by nature, are slightly irregular, and that makes sense to us. But man-made stripes, those exceptionally regular, crisply rendered lines, well, it's just too much for our brains to handle. According to a new study published in the journal Current Biology, humans didn't evolve to deal with the intense regularity of human-made stripes. The pattern is, after all, a relatively modern phenomenon. So when our brain sees this unnatural pattern, it responds by increasing gamma oscillations. What are gamma oscillations? Well, it's slightly complicated. But the gist is that the different regions of our brain, parts that control memory, attention, consciousness, and more, communicate by coordinating the firing of neurons. Those synchronized neurons are brain oscillations. And these waves come in different frequencies, with gamma being the highest frequency. There is still a lot of debate over the mechanics and function of the gamma oscillation, but one theory is that gamma oscillations play a role in transferring information between brain regions. Like if all these neurons are firing at the same time, the gamma waves help gather the various information, binds them together, and conveys a oneness. Kind of like putting the puzzle pieces together to reveal the image. It's been found that a boost in gamma oscillation activity is connected to headaches and seizures, which is why when looking at stripes, our brain kind of short circuits. Not knowing how to take in this highly regular pattern, our brain boosts the gamma oscillation, which is why some of us may suffer from visual distortion, migraines, or worse. But researchers did find that when vertical lines were distorted, either blurred or made irregular, the oscillations died down. But if you're prone to seizures or migraines, it's best just to avoid the pattern. And that does it for this episode of This Week I Learned. Look out for new episodes every Friday on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. To read more about any of the facts I've mentioned, you can go to theweek.com/podcasts, where you'll also find our 7-Minute Opinions and 7-Minute Explainer podcasts. And as a thank you for listening to this episode, we'd like to give you 4 totally free non-commitment issues of The Week magazine. To get those, visit theweek.com/4free. I'm Lauren Hansen, and thank you so much for listening.